This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Say a couple words for me real quick.
April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory with desire, stirring dried roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm.
I don't think we need to do anything else. I think this interview's over. That's all I needed. Abraham, welcome back.
What a pleasure to see you again.
Man, it's like the way we reconnected, it's been, I feel like there's a pandemic between us, huh?
Yeah, it's been that long, hasn't it?
It has.
And I thought it was very fitting that we see each other in the gym, where I don't know if your listeners know this, but I always like to rub my biceps against yours, hoping that there'll be some chromosomal translocation and I'll have the big pumped arms that I want.
I believe the osmotic gradient of musculature flows the opposite direction,
really,
Brother Abraham.
You're bad luck then.
it's so funny because we're, you know, two bald brown guys inevitably meant to meet. And I hadn't been to the Stanford gym in a good year because there was something that arose here that said, why am I doing this? Like, why am I going to the gym? Is it looking for some kind of validation? Is it a feeling of body unworthiness? Like, what is it? And I couldn't answer the question. And the body itself was telling me, just go walk a lot, man. You just turned 50, like, go walk. And so for a year, I was mostly walking. And then I would lift weights occasionally with my friend. And that was a social hour. And then suddenly something occurred. The body was like, nah, you need to move some heavy stuff around. And so I showed up that morning and I saw you there for the first time in a year.
That is wonderful. Yeah, I agree with you. I think walking is such a beautiful way to exercise. And, you know, at my age, I'm 68, going to be 69 shortly.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So, you know, I think working at like 70% of your maximal heart rate, burning fat as opposed to, you know, aerobic, you know, cardio reserves, I think it's much more peaceful and I can do it forever. Put on a good book, walk, and I come back. So, you know, energized.
See, I would never have thought you were 68. You see on camera how sexy he is, but in person, it's like, wow. So
yeah, it surprises me too. I don't know how it happened. It just snuck up on me.
It does. I'm going to be 51 this month. And it's like, where did that happen? And, but so yeah, that kind of keeping moving, as I get older, I feel like I'm listening to what the actual body is telling me instead of what the mind is telling me the body ought to be doing. Like this conceptual labeling of, oh, this is how you do this. And now instead it's like, I can feel like a desire to move or to move against resistance, to go out in nature or whatever it is.
I must say, I don't think that I would trade and go back again, you know, in the sense that I haven't just arrived at 68 with the, you know, wear and tear and body that I have, but I've also arrived with, you know, painfully learned wisdom along the way. And who would want to, you know, go relearn all that stuff again? So this is in a funny way, the happiest time of my life. I'm not talking about material success or anything like that. I'm just talking about in general, being more at peace. I mean, there's always a fundamental restlessness in me, but there's also, not a resignation, but an acceptance and, you know, sort of a broadening of my view. And, you know, it's not about me. It's not about anything. It's just about being, you know, the meaning of life is living. It's life.
You know, when you talk like that from that kind of presence, that's where I feel it in the body. Like I feel it right here when you talk like that, because for me, it's that discovery is so new, that discovery of it's okay just to be as you are in this moment and that you would never have it otherwise because it couldn't have been otherwise, the whole journey.
Yeah, it couldn't be. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that you'll get there. We'll all get there. You know, we all come to our own wisdom. Some people come to it terribly early and, you know, you just admire them. I mean, I knew physicians early in my career who, you know, weren't on the same career path that I was. Not because they weren't capable, but because they valued other things. They had the wisdom to know the importance of kids and family in a way that I don't think I was wise enough. And so I think we all come to our wisdom, and God bless you if you get it early. But the good news is that it awaits you.
It's somewhere. Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah. For me, it couldn't be more correct. And I say I'm still coming into my wisdom. But when I was young, there was so much of it was a goal-oriented kind of lifestyle and approach to everything. And it came a lot, I think, from the driving need to feel whole or in some way worthy or in some way validated. And so there's a lot of validation seeking. I literally wanted to be famous. Like that was it was written in my yearbook when I was in fourth grade. People would say, really hope you do become famous. Like that's how obvious it was. And feeling back into it, and having achieved some of that, a semblance of that, it's seen then like, oh, okay, that's what that is. Here's why I really wanted it, to try to feel like I was worth being alive, like it was worth taking up the space, because it didn't really feel like that. And so when you actually get the things you think you wanted and you realize what they are, you're like, oh, there is a fundamental truth here, which is this was not the answer. The answer was going back in and realizing you were always whole. were okay to be here. And in a sense, you have to go on that hero's journey to discover that you never left where you were trying to get, that it was always there. And it seems like you and I are saying, well, there's young people who figure this out. There are. But more often it comes later in life. And that's why I think there's so much hope for people to say, just relax. It'll get there.
Indeed. Yeah. Although I will say, as you were saying that, I was thinking you weren't wrong for seeking the things that you were seeking, because I think a lot of it is about personality. So I've come to really learn a lot about the Enneagram. I don't know
God. You know that. I am an Enneagram lunatic in my later life.
Yeah, me too.
It's so useful. Yeah.
I mean, I found it in a very strange way, because I was invited many years ago, almost 20 years ago now, to join a men's group in San Antonio. This was the husband of a patient of mine, and she'd gone through a harrowing experience, and her hospital room was like a sacred space, you know, where this, you know, where life was unfolding, or, you know, being threatened to be snuffed out. And in a very special way, I connected with her, but more so with her husband, who was always there. And he and a group of his friends, who were actually business rivals, were brought together by their pastor, who said, powerful men have no one to hold them accountable. And he challenged them to come together once a week and hold each other accountable. And they did so sort of grudgingly. They've been meeting for some 40 plus years. One of them has died. There's now seven of us left. And, you know, these are my brothers. We call each other our brothers. And we know all the tricks each other has. We know to call each other on our, you know, on our deceits, to ourselves.
Yeah.
And they were big believers in the Enneagram. And in that group of seven and eight, I could actually see the personality types sort of working out. So to be driven by ambition, to be driven by the desire to be appreciated for helping people, you know, whatever your drive is, it isn't bad. But I think having insight into, well, this is how I am, allows you to see when you're getting dysfunctional, you know, and I wish I had learned this much, much earlier.
I love everything you said. And for this reason, that we try in many ways, like on any journey, like a journey of self-improvement, a journey of, which is a little bit of an oxymoron, because there isn't a self really to improve. We're kind of improving this illusory operating system that the Enneagram points out, like the nine types of personality are really software algorithms that we kind of are running, that awareness is running. That's how I like to think about it. And they have different levels of function and dysfunction, different ways to integrate and disintegrate. And when we recognize that we're all actually in this world running those programs in a way, we can embrace it and go, yes. Like earlier you said, you know, I'm older now and I have this wisdom, but there's an underlying restlessness here. Yes, that restlessness, that urge to be, to actually manifest as a human and play out the dance is overwhelming. So then you can go and go, okay, when I was young, I was running the software of validation seeking, maybe Enneagram 3 more powerfully. And then that really evolved into what I am now, which is Enneagram 6, which is stability, fear of loss, loyalty, connections, that sort of thing. And then as that actualizes, it becomes somebody that can really provide stability and connection and teaching and those things, but only after going on the journey and realizing the levels that that can be quite dysfunctional when we identify with our personality, go, I am that, instead of, oh yeah, I contain that. And that's part of the way this Zubin runs.
I had you pegged as a 4, which is what I am. You know?
Beautiful. 4 is my second strongest trait.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it resonates with me, the need of the 4. I think it's even more interesting to look at what is the worst fear of the different Enneagram types. And the worst fear of the 4 is being insignificant, you know.
Yes.
Of just not distinguishing yourself in this life in some way. And again, I don't think one should fight that. It's nice to understand that's behind some of what makes you restless. And so you can let that go at times. You say, you know, I see where that's coming from.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think 69 is great for learning to sort of observe the emotion and not be the emotion. Yeah. Not always successful, as my friends will tell you, but nevertheless.
Can't be. We're humans. Yeah. I suspect 4, of course, for you, it just feels so correct. And there's a kind of there's a energy to a 4 that's like a brooding. I'll never forget, like I don't think I've ever told you this story. I talked to a young resident who had rounded with you. This was back when I was attending at Stanford and we had never met. And I was intrigued by you because I'd read some of your work and I was like, oh man, I got to talk to him at some point. And we ended up running into each other in like the physician lounge one day. And this was before Z-Dog MD ever existed. This was Dr. Zubin Damania. And he said, yeah, he's such an interesting guy because he's all about the art of medicine, but there's a melancholy or a kind of a sadness that pervades how he expresses. And I remember thinking, oh, you mean he's an artist? You know, there's there is this like desire to feel like you're seen for who you are and what are you? What is my identity? That beingness and it can feel like a real grind because the 4 for me is a strong presence. The 6 is stronger and the 7 kind of ties with the 6, this little bit of hedonism. Yeah.
Interesting. He should use the word melancholia to sort of describe the affect. I don't obviously see that, but interesting. Yeah.
It's a poignancy really that you don't always detect it in, say, a physician who's more of a 3, which is the achiever, the ambitious, they have a different, like, they're putting out a kind of a little bit of a mask to the world. Whereas the 4 is like, please see me for who I am. And the 6 is just like, who's going to tell me who I am? Who are the people that I can believe in that will provide the stability that then I'll be infinitely loyal to, right?
I mean, I think maybe what he was describing, I can't presume this, or she, was that I really have always felt that, you know, this is a relational business. It's not a transactional business. You know, I'm not going in there to figure out what the sodium was yesterday and is today and what we do. It's like, you know, what is this person feeling and experiencing? And in that sense, I think we all put on the necessary mask for that person, you know. And in my case, it's often a mask of always wearing a white coat and a tie and often looking more groomed than my residents, which I don't think is a bad thing. And I can sometimes witness the, you know, what they call in psychiatry, the transference that the patient puts on you, which is a good kind of transference. You know, you're managed by your gray hair and your manner to elicit a kind of confidence, not just in the scientific facts, but in the fact that you're caring for them, that would be harder to achieve if you were dressed more casually and, you know, had a different manner. So it's not one manner. I think it's a manner we all of us intuitively adopt for different situations, what the situation calls for, you know?
And this is something that I think younger people may miss this bit of wisdom, having not come into it yet, which is it's still an indicator of deep integrity and cohesion within a person to have different ways and personas with which we deal with different situations and people, because it is all relational. So yes, for me, especially for the early part of my career, wearing a tie and a shirt every single time, never wearing scrubs as a hospitalist, doing that allowed the patient to have that transference of trust.
Exactly.
For a young doctor,
yeah,
who still had hair.
Right.
And that was black. And so that was very important. But then coming home, I'm a joke. At home, I'm very calm and stable and always looking for threats. Like, what about our finances? What about our taxes? What about the very six kind of thing? But then with friends, that seven personality wing comes out.
Yeah, yeah.
The sort of buddy kind of like, let's go have a good time, and a lot of empathy and that, yeah, kind of thing. And those, you could say, if you watched that play out, this guy does not have integrity. He's not one person. And again, it's like, well, yeah, we contain multitudes. We are in relation to others always, and there really aren't others. So that's the paradox.
Yeah.
We're really in relation to ourselves.
I think most physicians, young physicians, whether they know it or not, they're gradually learning these things. It sort of goes with the territory. It's hard to just have one veneer that you apply everywhere. And, you know, I think with time, after all, no one taught me consciously any of this stuff, or you. I mean, they modeled behavior and, which is why I think the dearth of bedside rounds, where, you know, they get to round with you, you round with them, and, you know, you both learn from each other's way of dealing. I've learned a lot from watching the way residents do things that are different from mine, that I realize I had a lot to learn. But I also think that, you know, this is hard. It takes time. William Carlos Williams, the wonderful American poet laureate, who was also a physician, you know, he actually became a physician after he became a poet, because he felt that for a poet to really have meaningful things to write about, they needed to be in the river of life. They needed to be in the stream of life.
Mm.
And William Carlos Williams, I mean, you probably know his poetry anthologized everywhere, but famous one is the Little Red Wheelbarrow, glazed with rain. You know, I wish I could remember the whole thing to recite it. It's not that long, but he famously said to a medical student who was trailing him, because he spent his whole career in Paterson, New Jersey, practicing. When he was 70, he wrote to a friend saying, I'm finally giving up my evening clinics. You know, and he wrote his poetry in between patient visits. And he said to Robert Coles, who was the medical student following him, now a famous psychiatrist, he said to him, you know, what you don't realize is when you're dealing with a patient here, you're not dealing with a liver, a kidney, or a heart. You're dealing with one guy or one gal in distress in a unique way. And the physician on the front line falls back on his or her sense of self. You know, that was the line. It was just one line in a whole thing, bunch of things he said. But I thought it was perhaps the most profound line of advice I'd ever read, that, you know, your most powerful instrument is sort of having a very good sense of who you are and using that as a therapeutic instrument in order to make this interaction as seamless and efficient and healing and beneficial as it can be, you know. And to that end, you need to read them, and you need to chameleon-like almost be what it is that they would require of you at that moment, you know.
That is absolutely beautiful. And it's almost like you could change physician heal thyself to physician feel thyself, know thyself.
Exactly.
And because then that instrument that you are there as this instrument of suffering relief for them,
yes,
that you can actually be fully present as that instead of, and actually this, I think this actually relates a little bit to the Enneagram in a way, in this way. When I was young and I first discovered the Enneagram, maybe when I was 30, another physician that turned me on to it. And there are a lot of nerds out there who are into the Enneagram that way. You know? They want
to. I'm glad to hear. I think it's useful.
It is useful. But the way they approach it is they want to game it. They want to be able to manipulate others, knowing they're trying to figure out their Enneagram type. They want to find a mate that is a match with their Enneagram. For me, when it was first introduced and I took the test and I realized I was a six, I was heartbroken. devastated because the six sounded terrible to me. It sounded like a fear-driven, it just didn't sound like the vision I had for myself. But the more I read about it, the more I'm like, well, that's me. And then I thought, well, if that's me, like, I'm horrible. And it was all this identifying with the personality. Like, okay, now I feel ashamed that I'm this. I came back to the Enneagram only lately and I saw it as, oh my gosh, that's the software that I'm running and that's fine. So those are kind of vague constraints, but you can optimize that and be and still be the instrument that the patient needs or someone else needs.
Exactly, yeah.
Even and especially within the constraints. So you don't have to be a 3 or a 1 or a 9, heaven forbid a 9, the peacemaker, to be a great doctor. You could be whatever you are, but know what that software is.
Exactly, yeah.
And its parameters.
And I think for your listeners who are wondering what the hell we're talking about, there's so much written about it, but I love this book that I found very, you know, just very well written and thoughtful, small book called The Road Back to You.
Oh.
So if there's one book I'd recommend to your listeners, it would be The Road Back to You. Forgetting the author now. But coming back to William Carlos Williams, I just remembered the poem that that I was trying to recall.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
And I think it sort of embodies some of his teaching, which was you don't necessarily have to say, you don't necessarily have to, you just have to observe and be, and that quality is probably more important than you know, intervening in some way. And it's the poem goes like this, The Little Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends on a little red wheelbarrow glazed with rain beside the white chicken. Done, you know?
That's it.
Yeah, but you know, you sort of first read that when you're young, especially, you think, oh, what the hell? How did this become a famous poem?
Ah.
And then you realize it's just loaded with images and imagery. And ultimately, it's a mirror reflecting back on you and your state as you think of those images, you know. Who are you as you look at that, you know?
Ah, and that is the power of art and poetry, to express in words, which are typically a reductionist left brain entity that takes infinity and tries to bring it into knowing and uses those same words to bypass the left brain and bring us into capital K knowing, like knowing of the whole. So like you said, just a tiny number of words, and yet it the entire universe is there. The whole doctor-patient relationship is there. Your entire life is there. How? I can't tell you. The words point to the ineffable space in your own awareness that show you this.
Well said. Exactly.
And so, oh man, this is why I love talking to you so much. The whole reason I even asked you to come is I just wanted to hang out with you. And
yeah, I kept protesting that
yeah.
I don't have something new to talk about, and you know, let's.
This is literally what he said. He goes, "I'm a one horse pony when it comes to medicine, guys. I don't know if I have anything to say." And I'm like, "I don't care. I just want to hang out with you." And I'm rewarded in every moment with this.
Very kind.
Hey, sorry to interrupt this episode. It's Dr. Z. Just a quick pitch here. If you can just leave a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, it helps us a lot. I also want to hear what you think about this episode when you're done listening. hello@zdogmd.com. It's the best way for me to hear your voice because the emails come right to me. And we don't have a comment section on most podcast platforms. Maybe Spotify has one, but nobody else does. So it really gets your voice involved on episodes, especially that don't have a video. And the third thing is, if you want to be a part of this community and support the show, join our supporter tribe, zdogmd.com/supporters. You can join on YouTube, Locals, Facebook, Instagram. You get live videos with me where we're talking about these things in depth, uncensored, and your comments are fully incorporated as in real time. And then we do these Zoom meetings where it's really like a beautiful community where we share our experiences on the awakening journeyless journey. How are we going to transform ourselves so we can transform healthcare and education and government? Because those systems are epiphenomena of us. Until we wake up, those systems will stay asleep. They're just an expression of our own delusion. So being a part of that, it supports this message so others can hear it. And it also allows for our own collective growth. So we need each other in that way. It's really, really, really tightly interwoven and interdependent. That's it. Back to your regularly scheduled show. So I want to point to a poem that has affected me recently. And it goes back to this, we were talking about melancholia or a kind of a certain sadness. I consider that a gift to be able to feel that fully. And with patience, it's so important. And it gets into the idea of grief. So grief in its purest sense is something, we talk about pathological grief, we talk about healthy grief, we talk about grieving, we talk about the five stages of grief, all the ways we kind of conceptualize grief. What is grief really? And the poem that I'm thinking of, you may be familiar with, is David White's The Well of Grief. And it goes something like this. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, we'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else.
Beautiful.
And that points at feeling the feelings we are most afraid of, going into the well of grief to the place we cannot breathe until it is nothing but grief and it suffocates us. What's on the other side of that is the secret water from which we drink, the actual source of all. And so being able to be with a patient as the wheelbarrow, as that presence that bears witness to their grief, their suffering, what they're going through purely, as our mutual friend Sam Shem may say, the good practice of medicine is doing as much of nothing as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think your poem is a great illustration of the fact that I think we need poetry, we need fiction, we need art in our lives as physicians and healers. You know, I think I worry about a trend where we're all left brain, everything is data and facts, and I mean, if you just think of a silly example, I love the metaphors in medicine, the colorful metaphors of ages past, just fruit metaphors. I give you the mulberry molar, the scar, the strawberry tongue, which becomes the raspberry tongue the next day, the melon seed body of tuberculosis in the joint and the apple core lesion. And that's just fruits. Don't get me started on the non-vegetarian stuff. But there's not one metaphor of that equivalency in the last 100 years or 50 years that any of us have ever invented. Mind you, we have so many new ways of seeing the body, MRI, this and that, angio, CT, not one new metaphor. And I think it speaks to a paucity of imagination, and I think I know a lot of, colleagues who say, well, I don't read fiction. I'm a serious kind of guy. I only read nonfiction, and I just look at them with some concern because, you're a serious kind of guy. Are you aware that Uncle Tom's Cabin ended slavery in America? It was a novel, not a president, not a political scientist who did that. It was one novel captured the public's imagination. Or are you aware that the novel The Citadel by A.J. Cronin about medical conditions in a Welsh mining town, that novel captured the public's imagination in the UK, and it was the genesis of the National Health Service. So fiction, the great beauty of fiction, especially in medicine, is that it allows us to experience the lives of others. It's the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives. It leaves us with the rules, with understanding. And I'm sorry, you're not going to get that just by reading nonfiction or Harrison's Principles or Nelson's. You need to be rounded because this is a human-to-human transaction.
Does Penthouse Forum count? Because that I just want to know.
If it's part of your reading, absolutely.
I believe much of it is fiction. At least I like to think so because it seems rather fantastical. So this is what I think, what you pointed out is so beautiful. This is, I don't know if you know this basic metaphor, Dr. Ian McGilchrist, who is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist and philosopher in the UK. He wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary. And it's based on the left and right hemisphere of the brain because you brought up left brain. And this is, I'm going to throw this out to you and you can maybe reflect on it for me with your wisdom because I think you're deeply ingrained in this this is your, in many ways, your calling, Abraham, is what you've done here is the integration of right and left brain in a field that is increasingly left-brained. So this is, what he does is he starts by debunking the pop culture feeling of left and right brain. Left brain is the analytical, smart, rational, and the right brain is the emotional, you know, hysterical, artistic side. That's not quite right. And the way he proposes it is he says the right brain is the holistic, and he uses a lot of examples of neuroanatomy and science, how this works. The right brain sees the whole, integrates everything in context. It is a contextual, relational integrator. And over time, the left brain evolved as a way to take this whole and find parts and grasp and manipulate, which is why the left brain controls the right hand. And most people who are right-handed, it's the grasper. Why does it control language? Because language takes the whole and reduces it to subject, object, and parts, subject, verb, object. And so it is a tool. And in the parable of the master and his emissary, the master is a wise king who sees all, but he realizes his kingdom is growing more and more complex. So he has an emissary, a servant, the left brain, who goes out to manage the bureaucracy of the world. However, the left brain, having speech and knowing the bureaucracy and controlling the levers of power, ultimately usurps the master and now becomes everything. So now the world is a dead, bureaucratic set of parts that try to recreate a whole that doesn't make sense, instead of sending it back to the right for wisdom. And this is what we find happening in society and in medicine. In medicine, it used to be almost entirely right brain. Then we get some balance. And then it is a series of click boxes in Epic, a series of ultrasound results. And what you're pointing at is that integration of left and right. So I think it's a beautiful metaphor for how we might have gone wrong and how we might go right again.
I should look for that book. That's beautiful. It reminds me, that title reminds me of a book I heard about years ago when I was in Iowa in the writer's workshop. It was called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind.
Oh, wow.
You know, so there was a point where we didn't have a corpus callosum and any sort of division, you know, real or otherwise. And so our dreaming and our waking were all merged into one. You know, one couldn't quite tell which was which. And then with the evolution, I mean, there are neuroscientists who are going to call in and fault me with this, but with the evolution of the hemispheres and the corpus callosum, we had more discrete separation, lots of integration, but separation. So you knew when you were conscious and you knew what was dream and unconscious, or at least you thought you did. And the interesting thing is when I reach the age I have reached, I sometimes feel like I invite the breakdown.
Yes. Yes.
I invite the bicameral mind. I love this idea of my dreams and conscious and subconscious all floating together. And in a way they do, you know, you're having a quiet coffee in a cafe, you know nothing about the people in front of you, but you are making up your own little tales and stories about them based on nothing, or maybe based on things that your conscious mind no longer is capable of registering. So who knows, you know?
Absolutely. It's as if consciousness, that space of thought, which I know you are a meditator, I'm a meditator, you can access this space as pure, awake thought stuff, and you can see thoughts kind of evolving. Dream, waking state, all of it is one kind of space there, and thought goes out in the world. It's a kind of a left brain process and labels and says, Abraham is here and this and this. And so we can actually change those. We create our world in that sense. That's why fiction is so beautiful, because you're creating a world here, but you're allowing the reader to take their own consciousness and overlay whatever meaning and story they want.
Very much so.
And that breakdown where there's integration. So one of the most interesting experiments, I think, in modern medicine is the severing of the corpus callosum in certain patients with seizures, and noticing with very clever testing that now there are two separate personalities operating. And it turns out, and McGilchrist actually goes through the qualitative differences in personality between these hemispheres, and it's really quite remarkable. The right hemisphere is more pessimistic. It's more melancholy. It sees,
word again.
Isn't that interesting? It sees the world as very nuanced. The left hemisphere is a bit of an asshole. So it actually knows it's right. It confabulates when asked questions it doesn't know the answer to or doesn't have access to. And it is irrationally optimistic in many ways because it thinks it knows. The right knows it doesn't know. And so you need both in a way, but we are as a society shifting towards a kind of left hemisphere dominance. And you can see it in our discourse, the polarization, the way that everybody's got to be right, the absolutism, the black and whiteness. Yeah.
You know, and this circles back to our discussion about the bedside and the patient, because, you know, I strongly believe in the physical exam because I hate to be the one to miss obvious phenotypic things that are glaring at me and have the radiologist call me and say, by the way, do you know your patient has bilateral breast masses or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
But more than, you know, more than just the phenotypic observations that are important. And, you know, it bears reminding that you can't diagnose Parkinson's, ALS with a blood test. You have to examine the patient.
Mm.
You can't make sense of any CT finding in the brain if you don't examine the patient and see what the functional deficit is. It might be meaningless or it might be profound, but only an exam will tell. There's no tick box that's going to tell you that, you know? But I always feel like more than that, there is something about the exam, you know, the privilege of being allowed to examine the patient, especially if you do it skillfully. It's a ritual, you know? It goes back to antiquity. But in its present form, it still looks very strange to others. You know, it's in a room that doesn't look like any room in your house or mine.
Mm.
One individual is in a white shamanistic outfit with tools in the pocket. The other is in a paper gown that no one knows how to tie or untie. And you know, a stranger is telling this other person all their ills. And then one individual disrobes and allows touch. And, you know, so it's a very profound ritual. It has all the trappings of ritual. And if you do if you execute it well, which is why it's important to do more than a half-assed prod of the belly and stick your stethoscope on the gown, you know, if you do it well, not only do you extract information, you get this validation, you get a bonding. All rituals are about crossing a threshold, you know, weddings, baptisms.
Mm.
This one is about the sealing of the patient-physician relationship. And we know that you and I are great judges of how well a barista, a hairdresser, a mechanic is doing their job. I mean, we may not be able to do what they do, but we know when someone takes pride in what they're doing
pride.
And well.
Mm.
Well, patients are just as good,
just
if not
as
better at judging us.
Better know? Because they have more at stake.
Yeah, and I think that in doing the ritual, even, you know, there are times when I'm doing a physical, I already know the answer from the history, or I know it because the patient has arrived with the answer. But I still do the physical because, you know, there is this whole right brain thing, call it whatever you want, right brain, subconscious healing, that needs to be ministered to. Just because I understand it cognitively on paper and can describe it to them in a biopsy report or an image doesn't begin to make sense of this for them, you know?
Mm.
And I think there's something in the exam that you're locating this disruption in their life on their body, not on a screen somewhere, not on a consultant's report, but on their body somehow, you know?
Mm.
And I think the more postmodern and sophisticated we get, the more self-conscious we seem to be about what are elemental needs for all human beings, especially in distress.
Yeah. it just tickles something in me that gets tickled when truth is spoken, because that's what it is. And I'll add something here and you tell me what you think, and that was beautifully put, my gosh. We have, and this is something that also happens in lesions in the right brain or lesions where the left brain is dominant. The body starts to feel like a machine to the human. The human perceives the body as a piece of mechanism in right brain lesions, We're just unopposed left brain. And when you talk to a patient, when you do the U-turn at the foot of the bed and you're just like, okay, here are the results, here's the labs, here's what we're going to do. What you've done is you've created a conceptual left brain map of their body. And you're saying, this machine is malfunctioning in this way. When you embody the diagnosis and the process by laying hands, by touching on the physical body, this becomes embodied in a way that it engages this right brain. And then it's no longer this reductionist parts creating a whole, it's whole, whole, whole the whole time. And I think that's part of the ritual there. And Joseph Campbell would approve, you know, he would say, yes, this is the power of myth, the power of ritual, the power of human touch is part of the hero's journey in all of this, establishing that covenant, that bond.
Very much so. I think, you know, one doesn't need to have explanations to know that certain things are welcomed by the patient and good for them and, you know, good for the doctor. But it's nice to have the explanations catch up, you know?
Mm.
Recently, I went to an Ayurvedic resort and I've done this a couple of times.
Yeah, beautiful.
And they have this technique where two people often are massaging at the exact same time in the exact same part of the body. So as they're moving from your feet to your knees, they're doing it in sync.
Mm.
And, you know, it might just seem like a gimmick of this particular place, but they do it in many different places. And then recently I read a report about simultaneous sensory stimuli and their effect on, you know, stimulating the cortex on both sides in certain ways, you know. So you could say at one level, oh, these Ayurvedic guys were pretty smart. They knew about this. Hell no, they didn't know about it. They just knew that it was good.
Mm.
And, you know, we're catching up with explanations after the fact. We don't need a lot of explanation to know that when you manifest caring and concern with scientific capability at the bedside, and you come across as human and not transactional, and as you said, you don't discuss the body as though it's a car with parts that need to be replaced, but, you know, you also take into account the profound spiritual wounding that happens whenever a patient feels like something's not working. You don't need proof to show that this is good, but, you know, the proof is there. It's coming, but God forbid we need to wait for those things to do what seems, as human beings, intuitive. I mean, I always point out that we can raise a child, a baby, we can raise a baby for 6 months using robots. I mean, after all, if you can take out the gallbladder, you know, with Da Vinci, you can change a diaper and do all those things. We wouldn't dream of it.
Yeah.
We recognize that a child needs nurturing and cuddling. And, you know, I think a patient, an ill patient especially, is in a certain way infantilized. And they have need for us to not be paternal or maternal and swoop in, but they have need for care. They have the need for us to care for them. And I think it's one thing our health systems struggle to do is to, other than in slogans and logos, to express care in a profoundly human way. I think individual nurses, individual physicians do it very well, but as a corporation, sometimes it's a struggle to make that happen.
And the corporation is the expression of that left brain reductionist bureaucracy where they are trying to say, well, okay, we can measure this, we can diagnose this, we can turn this into a Toyota assembly line, which, hey, for Toyota, that is a magical thing. It is absolutely been transformed the manufacturing reliability process, and it apply now. GE is taking lean, Toyota, wonderful, and we can apply some of that to medicine, sure. But when it is, again, the emissary usurping the master, then we get this disharmony. And I think what you're pointing at is the source of a lot of what we're calling burnout for caregivers, because we know we're humans. We were raised by other humans, not by robots. So we know that's why we're so concerned on some level about the advent of AI and how the corporate overlords are going to say, okay, now we're going to have AI do this. We're going to have it raise the child for 6 months because it knows better than you do what it needs.
Yeah. Yeah, when I hear, you know, administrators talk about Six Sigma or Lean, you know, I just feel like we're in trouble.
You want to die?
Yeah, we're in trouble.
And I mean, I get it for a process in the hospital that has to do with, you know, material management or environmental science, whatever it is. But for sitting at a bedside, doing what you're pointing at, it has no place there. It can't.
Yeah, but realistically, I think the bigger problem that we're all facing is, you know, we have a really screwed up you know, a reimbursement system. Yeah. It's a really screwed up healthcare system. And yet it's a $4 trillion something industry. It's
albatross.
So lucrative. Yeah. You know, it's so many people feeding at the trough, but we're paying people to do things to patients and not for patients.
That's right.
And you try to change any of that mix and the lobbyists will eat you alive, you know, because they have their people. So we need great administrators to eke out of this, you know, screwed up system, some measure of, you know, return that allows us to employ people and, you know, do the things we do. But at every level, it's a deeply cynical, flawed system. Mm. You know, we're all committing a form of moral perjury every time we tick more boxes on the chart to, you know, bill at a certain level versus this level, you know. And I mean, I think it's damaging to us to reflexively do that without a second thought.
It is. It's moral injury.
Yeah.
Every time it's a little paper cut, a little moral wound each time. And it's often unconscious, which makes it worse because it's not brought into light. And so it's hurting us. And we wonder why we're a little reactive at home or we're feeling disengaged or we're willing to compromise on certain things. Whereas before we never would have, you know, that idealism of early medical school, where is that gone? Some of it's tempered with wisdom, right? And some of it is just morally injured into oblivion.
Exactly.
By this, and it is, a lot of it is the reimbursement and the lobbying. And honestly, nobody will talk about that directly because they'll say, well, then, so what do you propose? Nationalized healthcare, you know, and they'll use words like socialism and communism and they'll do that. And then the lobbyists will come and there's so much money, like you said, at stake, livelihoods at stake. Nobody's talking about, well, what if we just grew the pie and made those livelihoods into something else, which when you talk about AI, they say that all the time. Like the same people will say, well, AI, no, don't worry. It won't replace your job. It's just going to grow the pie so that we can, it's like, okay.
You know, I must say, I see some hopeful trends. I mean, they came out of great sorrow and pain, but you know, the great distress of seeing physicians leave medicine, it breaks my heart to see people leave medicine in the sense that after all that training, after all that work, if we didn't create an environment that made them want to keep doing this, and they're so burnt out. But those who stayed, you're seeing this phenomenon of unions forming, not just house staff, but, you know, medical groups, physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that's not an easy way to get what you want, but it's kind of a necessary way to have your voice heard.
Mm.
And similarly, I think, you know, for years, people just kept laying down more keystrokes for us to, you know, to do that, and not realizing that every keystroke was like another piece of weight on the camel's back, you know, until you know, crippled it. And now, belatedly, you know, they're trying to ease this and ease that. But I think the pain will lead to correction. You wish you didn't have to go through the pain, but the pain is leading to correction. The pendulum is swinging back. I think there's going to be a forced correction. And at some point, the lobbyists will have to be defeated because businesses can't afford to insure people. And so they'll go to Congress and say, you know, screw that. You got to help us provide health care.
Yeah. Do actual care. Pay to keep people well. Pay to establish this relationship-based care rather than transactional care. And that's what we were calling, you know, are calling health 3.0, this more transcendent, integral, right-left hemisphere combined. And you could say the entire healthcare system, our whole platform is undergoing the hero's journey. It starts at the 1.0, the old patriarchal doctor in exchange for a chicken will do stuff that's not science-based, but is intuition and ritual-based, and that's beautiful. Then 2.0, which is this mechanistic, reductionist, left brain thing, and that's the sort of valley of despair that everybody's unhappy. The only people who aren't unhappy are the people really making a lot of money, and they really don't touch patients, typically. And then to have that kind of, there's that whole process with Joseph Campbell in the hero's journey of a death, a kind of facing the adversary and dying. So dying to what the old system was, and then the rebirth, atonement, and return home with the wisdom. And I think that's what great literature actually points at, because often it is the hero's journey and it is so relational.
Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, it's a shame that we have to go through these painful deaths and corrections
right
to get there, but it's sort of necessary. You and I have talked about my my experience with my latest novel, The Covenant of Water.
Yeah.
I think you made the assumption that it was all roses.
It sounded so great. I got to be honest with you, Abraham. When I saw it come out, because I saw you writing it, we interviewed you and you had your whiteboard with all these incredible complexity. And I know how hard it was for you to do that. It looked excruciating at times, and struggling with the muse and this story coming from nowhere through you, really. And then when I saw it and it was so successful, and there you are with Oprah and it's book of the month or whatever it is, and you're sitting with Oprah, and there was a part of me that was like, oh my God, Abraham is crushing the game. And there was a part of me that was like, jealous. Oh my gosh, I want to do something like that. And so, but the reality is much more complex.
Yeah. When I met you, I mean, I told you that what had happened is after the success of my previous book, Cutting for Stone, publishers were willing to come at me with big advances because, you know, they saw me as the golden goose ready to lay another golden egg.
Yeah.
And the sad part is I succumbed to that. I thought maybe I am the golden goose. Maybe I'll do this again.
And that's natural. That's absolutely natural.
And, I think, but when I got to writing, it took a lot more time than they were ready for. They were patient, but not that patient. And ultimately, they wanted the product. They didn't really care about the process, which is not unfair. But at some point, I felt that my editor had lost sight of what the story was, and that if they published it, it would not do justice to the decade or more I'd spent with it.
Mm.
And so I broke the contract, a great penalty.
That is terrifying.
I had to pay them back the big advance they'd given me. I mean, substantial for me. And now I had a tainted manuscript that I had to shop around, and publishers were viewing me with a certain jaundiced
eye.
Here's the guy who hasn't delivered. And, you know, it's just my good fortune. I met a young editor, Peter Blackstock, who was at the smaller of the big four or five publishers, you know, and it just resonated with him. And one of the first things he said to me is, Abraham, a book needs to be as long as it needs to be. Whereas the other publisher had been obsessed with the length of it. So, I mean, at that point, I was happy to just get it published and hope that one day I'd pay off what I owed to the previous publisher. And so everything that happened after that just felt like gravy, felt like doubly rich and meaningful because of the lows that I'd gone through. And I think life is very much like that. So, and now I'm under no illusion, you know. I think this is a very American thing where you do one thing and, you know, in the next sentence, somebody will ask you after complimenting you, and what's next? You know, the assumption being that if you don't follow this up with another and another and another, then you're nothing, you know? And I'm very comfortable with the knowledge that this was probably one of the best things I could ever write, if not the best thing. And for the things to come together in just the special way they did, you know, the fall and the rise and, you know, Oprah. How can I ever expect such a thing to happen again? So I'm very content to just stop right there. The reality is I will write because I love to write. I will write because I use writing as a way to understand what I'm thinking. But I don't feel any pressure to, you know, do it again and do it again, except for the pure joy of it, you know. And I think that's maybe also a function of my age, that I don't need to.
Yeah.
Again and again and again, be reborn again and accept it as the celebrated author du jour, which only lasts about 2 days before you're no longer.
You're on to the next thing mentally, right? The dopamine's worn off. Right.
Exactly. So,
you know,
interesting time to be in. So I'm actually, you know, delighting in the book, enjoying the conversations I have with individual readers who take the trouble to write to me. And that's really who I love to hear from, because I'm writing in such isolation, you know, in a room not unlike this, you know, cut off from the world, but always, 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 always imagining that moment when the reader engages with the book, with the words, and trying to be patient, not to overburden them, you know, but to give them enough. And so when I hear back from them, that is the reward, you know. You know, everything else has been wonderful, but to feel like you wrote a story that resonated for other people, that, you know, many of these letters begin with, I've never written to an author in my life, but, you know, wow. So I couldn't be happier.
Ah, Ah. Do you know how I know this book was your just magnum opus? Is that you read it for the Audible version, and when I listened to your reading of it, and I'm still listening to the book, it's a journey. This is the thing. When I listen to it, there's never a desire to find out what happens next. There's always just the majesty of you reading these characters and them coming to life in your mind in that moment. And it's like, ah, and then when I put it down to do the next thing, it feels like a complete novel, having heard 20 minutes of you reading it. And the passion that you put, and I know how hard it is to read that much audiobook. It was beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you, my friend.
Beautiful.
To have you listening to it is it's a wonderful coming full circle, if you like, and I'm honored.
I have to be honest, I'm envious of your accents. They're so good. They're so good.
Well, you know, the reason I read it is because it's normally a red flag for an author to read their own book, of fiction especially.
I didn't know that.
Brad Pitt records Cormac McCarthy stuff.
Right.
Meryl Streep just did Tom Lake by Ann Patchett, because you have to perform a book.
That's so different
from writing.
That's right.
But I knew that my book was so full of ethnic terms, and even Meryl Streep, Brad Pitt, would have butchered those things, you know?
It was so perfect that you read it. And I know exactly what you're saying, yeah.
I had to learn how to, you know, pitch my voice up and down for female, male on the same page, and do accents, but not overdo them. You know, it was all a learning experience. It was a wonderful experience because prior to this, I've never read any of my books. I've never picked them up to read again because by the time they're published, I've done them thousands of revisions, you know.
Yeah.
And when I reread them, my instinct is to grab a pen to correct something. So it spoils the experience. I can't experience the book. But this one, because I recorded it, I actually experienced my novel all over again, you know, and there was a very different meta understanding of what it was I was doing.
I think every expression of that kind of art is its own thing. So you're reading it is its own expression of that, and reading it myself would be its own. I'm going to do both, but like, I tell you, there's something about hearing Abraham, the intimacy of that is beautiful. And the fact that you know who these characters are. And so you're expressing them as you conceive them, but I'm going to still interpret them through my own lens. It's just magical.
You're very kind.
It's magical. And now, so this struggle, this is the artist struggle. This is the struggle of the Enneagram 4, is finding someone to actually trust and believe in who they actually know themselves to be, not who someone else thinks they are. And that's the struggle in the modern culture of creativity. I talk to documentary makers who say the entire game has been changed by the streamers, the Netflixes and the HBOs that now pay for these things. They know what generates click-throughs and streams, and they want to tailor and optimize for that, not for nuance, not for truth, not for art, for that. And it's heartbreaking to them because they have to compromise so much if they're going to be financially viable, if they're not going to have to return the massive advance and get the development budget. And the ones that stick to their guns are the ones that I end up connecting with. If they're doing a documentary where they're asking me to be a part of it, I'm like, okay, yeah, this I will do, but I have to talk to them and feel what they're expressing. Yeah.
I think you need a lot of confidence in, I mean, speaking about you, you're as an artist, you need confidence in your art to not have your art get sort of derailed by the, you know, by the latest thing, by whatever the in thing is now and the trends that are pulling you some way. You have to be able to resist that and stay true to yourself. Tell us about your journey. Let me interview you for a change. What's been going on with where you are from the time these wonderful podcasts started to where you are now?
So I'm glad we're now talking about my most, my favorite subject, me. As a narcissist, it's funny because I feel such kinship to you in terms, even though we're in totally different spaces and different leagues, honestly, like what you're doing is just beyond. For me, it's been a journey in that initially it was this seeking of validation. And a feeling like in medicine, when I was at Stanford, I wasn't living my story anymore. I was for a long time. And then it suddenly clicked that I wasn't anymore. And it was really, I could correlate it to a few things. One is when Epic really became dominant and there was a lot of charting at home because I cared a lot about the patients. I wanted to do a good job and I felt accountable, not just to the patients, but to my group of other physicians for whom, on whose behalf I was taking care of their patient in the hospital, keeping them safe from the danger of the hospital. The hospital's most dangerous place in the world, short of a war zone, maybe even more dangerous. So at some point, Epic went live and they started pulling back our resident and house staff coverage. So they had the attending physicians do more and more by themselves. So we became more of a machine and less of a mentorship, connection, relational thing. And that's when I started getting that sense of I'm burning out. And it wasn't really, it was this moral, just repetitive moral injury. So that's when I started making videos and my deceased late friend, Tony Shea, who that's a whole nother conversation. He told me, why don't you do what you really feel called to do and teach patients to stay out of the hospital? And you can do it on YouTube because that's the thing now. This was 2009. So I started doing that with a lot of fear, thinking Stanford would get angry and so on. And as it started to click, I got more bold. And then I started getting the validation of the number of views and the likes and the feedback. And so it became another thing for the personality to go chase. Okay, well, now I'm on this journey. Now I want to get as much influence as possible. And I love what I'm doing. You could feel it. You're like, the body lights up. I love doing this. I could do this all day and night and never get tired. So I did that in conjunction with starting this clinic in Las Vegas and trying to actualize the things we talked about. But a lot of that, I felt like an imposter. I felt like this is not my skill set running a clinic. It's not my skill set marketing a clinic to patients. This feels gross. And I realized as we wound down that clinic, our partners who we built the clinic with, Iora Health, they were doing a great job. They had big teams to do this. So I could evangelize the model and do what I'm good at, which is expressing and teaching and that relational aspect of it. And they could go build it. And they did for Medicare Advantage. And then they merged with One Medical. Wow. And One Medical merged with Amazon. And now that model is owned by Amazon. And we'll see what happens. Either Amazon will ruin it or it will be a pressure for others to focus and invest in preventative primary care that's relationship-driven, technology-enabled, but not technology-enslaved, and right brain, left brain in harmony. And so that's the hope. But all that said, then I started doing this and I started getting interested in awakening and meditation and personal transformation and all of that. And then it started, there was this crisis because COVID happened and put a delay on everything because then I could speak about things I was passionate about and people wanted to hear it. They wanted to validate it with engagement and becoming subscribers and so on. So I was delayed in the reckoning. And the reckoning was the whole fame and influence and validation thing is a fickle beast because when things change, people and the system and people want TikTok. They don't want 5-minute music video parodies. They don't want to hear a doctor do a 2-hour show about what we're talking about. They want this quick soundbite. But this is what I want to do. So there was a process of grieving, a process of going through the shadow of, am I even worthwhile as a human? Like, can I support my family? Like, is there, as a 6, as an Enneagram 6, is there safety and security in what I'm doing or should I go and play the game? And then realizing now at my age and with the little bit of wisdom that I've gained from the meditation and the retreats and the work that's happened, I can't do it. I have to be authentically what's here. And if that's 10 people watching something that I do or me not doing it, that's okay. But that journey was one of abject torture and it's still unfolding in a way, but in a way I'm on the other side of it where now I'm like, you know what, Abraham, let's just hang out and do a show. And if people watch it, great. And if not, that's great. And I'm just so honored that you would come and talk with me.
I didn't realize we'd met at that juncture in your thoughts on this show. But I mean, I commend you on being honest enough to reflect on it in this fashion. It takes a lot of courage to say no, or, you know, I'm going to try something slightly different, you know, come what may. Mm. It takes courage, but God bless you and do it. Do it. Follow your heart. I think that's the only advice I give people is, you know, It doesn't work when you're doing something to satisfy somebody else. You just have to follow your heart if it's feasible.
Yeah, if it's feasible.
It's not.
And if it's not, that's okay. Then, and I tell people this because they say, but I can't do that because I have a mortgage and I have kids and I have this. And I'm like, okay, so you go and you're as present as you can be doing what you need to do to support them, knowing the whole time that, you know, maybe there's a compromise here and there, but really it's not a compromise if you're doing it wholeheartedly and with full presence, knowing that it's not permanent and that sometimes you do have to pay the dues. You do have to go on the hero's journey. You do have to suffer the death. You do have to sell out for a period.
Yeah.
And then come back to realize it didn't give you the happiness you wanted. Like you said, you said something very important. You said you get this amazing thing when the book is out there, and then 2 days later, it's the next thing.
It's gone.
Yeah, it's the human condition.
What are you writing next?
That's right. It's a seeking why. It made me think of Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love, and she did that TED talk about how she could never live up to that first book.
Yeah.
And the amount of shame and the challenge. And it's the same with me. You know, people will say, I liked you better when you talked about medicine all day and you were making music videos. And I remember I liked your show back then. And it used to be a wound when I would hear that. And now it's like, I'm so glad that that touched you in that way. I'm not doing that now, but that was beautiful that happened and that I had the privilege of being able to connect with people. And it's the same thing. Like when people connect with the work, whatever it is, it's this ineffable joy. And it'll get you every time. When you were describing it, I found myself really feeling it emotionally because that's what it is. It's this relational connection with others. That's what we secretly want. It's not even secret anymore, right? At our age, it's like, no, I want that. I want that connection. Yeah.
I think what you do is, you know, what writers try to do is you're articulating the thoughts and emotions that everybody feels, but you manage to, through your wisdom, the guests you bring in, you manage to put color and you fulfill the palette so this thing takes more shape for your listeners. So it's a valuable function. Well, you know, as you said, if it's 10 or 10 million, it's a valuable function.
I'm going to hire you to make me feel better about what I do. That was such a nice articulation.
And I want you to hire me to be your bass guitarist while we do a little guitar duo one day on the show.
Oh my God. We can be Bald and Balder.
Bald and
Balder. That'll be the name of the Bald and the Beautiful. And oh, I love it. And you know, you are a musician and I think your children are musicians and you come from that.
I'm not up to their standard, but you know, like I guess it's a metaphor for life. We're all aspiring to be the lead guitarist.
Yes.
So meanwhile, we bang on the same 7 chords we know on.
I play the same scale patterns. How many pentatonic variations can I do until it gets really old? Yeah. So this idea of, again, like the arts, the sciences, they're being not two. There is this integration of it. And this is why I love, I mean, we've talked now, probably this is our third or fourth time talking, because I feel drawn to those expressions as opposed to the pure one or the other, which those are beautiful expressions too, but there's something about the synthesis and you'll never be good at all of it, but there's something about the synthesis that's bigger than any of the sum of the parts. And I think that's where this right hemisphere analogy really shines, is like it sees this thing as part of a tapestry. It cannot be outside of it. There is no outside. There's nowhere to go. It's all this. And that's what, through your art, like when you weave the tapestry of these generations of people tied together by this thread over space and time, there's an eternity there at the center of it that's still center, that it's all radiating in, and you feel it. You feel it in the work.
Yeah. And I think some of the best scientists that I have the privilege to sort of see from a distance at Stanford, they, you know, they have a creativity that you know, erases left versus right. I mean, they're just sort of seeing, feeling, and then knowing to ask outrageous questions. And sometimes it's in that outrageousness, that leap of imagination, that they make this connection. I mean, the kind of things we're doing now, CRISPR and this and that,
you know,
it didn't come from people stolidly pushing one brick forward. It was also leaps of imagination. The progress of science has never been linear. It sort of plateaus and then there's this big breakthrough and then it plateaus, you know. And I think that's a reflection of how these are just one thing.
One thing.
Yeah.
One thing. The whole is, in a way, the whole is speaking through these people. Yeah. It's everything that's ever happened since the Big Bang is showing up only eternally now, and it's going relativity. Here you go, Einstein. When Einstein calms his brain, it was described this way to me that I thought was very beautiful. Einstein would describe this process. He would say he would learn everything he could. He would acquire knowledge, and then he would reach this particular wall. And many people would then take a lateral turn along the wall and try to acquire other wider knowledge to solve the problem. What he would do is he would hit the wall and then he'd go, that's all I can do. Now I'm going to relax. And in that relaxation, that induction of the entirety of everything came forth and said, it's this. And it's that, that's where that space that we create from stillness, from sitting with the patient at the bedside and putting a hand and just being quiet, that we seem in our institutions to rob us of that space, but it's our space. They can't take it from us. So we can re-inhabit it. It's a simple thing. When you're sitting at Epic trying to chart, turn the screen to the patient and create the document together with them. I mean, they're simple things, but again, it points right at what you're pointing at, this inductive, indescribable, ineffable knowing that makes you wonder, when we wonder why AI can do these things that seem so human sometimes, it makes me think, I wonder if it's because we programmed the thing using the same approach, which is take all this data and then combine it in ways that are almost ineffable. And then sometimes it'll surprise you. Other times it'll do exactly what you think, which is reductionist nonsense garbage. And it doesn't need to be conscious to be able to do that. Yeah. Yeah. That's a whole can of worms too.
That's another can of worms.
Maybe for another discussion.
We'll solve that the next one.
So what, now I was almost going to ask you the typical interviewer question, which is really stupid, which is, what's next for you, Abraham? Now that you've crushed the world of literature and medicine simultaneously, what's the next big production? But I know that that's not it.
Yeah, I'm actually still trying to discover what that is.
Exactly.
It's exactly a year since I got the call from Oprah. You know, I thought someone was pulling my leg.
That's crazy.
And it's a whirlwind year of touring and, you know, great things with the book. But I'm, you know, I'm back to sort of that elemental struggle of the empty page and you and all these unformed thoughts in your head. But, you know, there's always the first step, which is get your ass in the chair. It doesn't happen without that, you know. And so that's the step. Sit in the chair, look at the paper. Then, you know, let it happen.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And that's beautiful advice for our incoming medical residents that are going to start soon. People ask, what's my advice? And I used to give these very like concrete medical to sort of thing. Oh, make sure to do this and get this piece of software and do this. And now it's like, sit still, feel into what you're doing. And I often tell, and this is one thing, and maybe we can end with this because I'm curious what you think about this and whether this is important in your own experience. But I think in many healthcare people, there's a profound sense that may be ingrained from very young of unworthiness or shame. Like there's a part of us that we feel like is somehow deficient, somehow not enough. And we try to fill it with helping others or this accomplishment or this mindset of achievement. And many people in medicine that I've talked to, and Emily Silverman, who runs a beautiful podcast called The Nocturnist, has talked in a whole series on shame in medicine. And how that shame body that we're hiding from with our accomplishments can be triggered when we're sued for malpractice, we make a mistake, or a patient yells at us, or an administrator tells us that we're not productive enough, or fill in the blank. And now we have residents that are coming in as interns. They're going to be in a situation where they're challenged in every way. And their shame body can either be repressed, provoked, or you can sit and go, yeah. As an apparently separate being, we're never going to feel perfect. There's always going to be a bit of a hole. So part of the joy of life is knowing that and then filling it in the moment with whatever's expressing and forgiving ourselves, you know?
Yeah, I think I would subscribe to that. I think many, many people, if not all people, are somewhat wounded by the process of childhood. You know, it's inevitable. But many of us coming to medicine are in some way wounded and hoping that in serving others, we're healing our wounds. But I think there's a point where you need to sort of transcend that because the medicine does heal your wounds. And then now that you're healed in a sense, and hopefully you continue to do what you're doing, but then what? Then you move on to something else, whatever that something else is. And I think for many people, it's an even more profound connection with the patient, the recognition that I'm no longer wounded. I'm no longer using you to serve my purpose in a sense, but now that I'm fully complete, I'm better able to serve you. But I love what you said, because I have a close oncologist friend, my colleague, and you know, he sees far more difficult things than I do in a sense. And he has this mantra, you know, which is find beauty and be still. He's a man of very few words, and I see him do that. I literally see him drive somewhere, you know, take planned trips, no exotic agenda, is, you know, New Zealand or his backyard. Find beauty, be still.
That's it. And so my advice to these residents is exactly that. And it means being able to look in those places that you haven't looked in you. So doing that bit of work, that you want to help patients, you want to help others, and this is a genuine passion for people on this path. You have to forgive, help yourself in that way, have self-compassion. And it's very difficult for this phenotype, I think. Many of us who have played this game to get into medical school and have tried to outrun that sense of the one there that isn't worthy. So turn back in and realize, yes, of course, you're worthy. You're worthy to be here. And then when that is allowed, stillness and beauty are the natural birthright that are here that allow you then to devote that to the patient. And that's the beauty. And you know, honestly, Abraham, there were times in my career where that was lost. And that's when I felt the most disconnected. That's when I think I felt the most burned out. And those are all words to describe this alienation from self that then alienates us from others. And there were other times in my career, both before and after that, where the connection was so apparent. It was so felt and embodied that you couldn't even talk about it. It just was naturally apparent. And that comes from, some people are gifted with it, but I think it comes from some work, some doing this. Listening or reading to beautiful literature, listening to art, listening to poetry, writing poetry, sitting with the blank page. And I think your being here today has reminded many that'll listen to this of exactly that.
Well, what a pleasure to talk about things like this. So important.
It's a joy, brother. I hope you'll come back.
Anytime. Call me.
Oh, man.
Don't wait till we run into each other in the gym.
We'll have to have a bicep off. You know, it'll be a battle of the.
Oh, I'll lose that.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. And man, yeah, I want whatever magic youth elixir you have. Blood transfusion, maybe?
Maybe so.
Yeah, I don't think it works like that, but some of the tech bros think so. Thanks so much. So guys,
thanks for having me.
Please check out Abraham's book, The Covenant of Water. It is a masterpiece, and I don't say that lightly. And if you like this type of format and you want to give me some validation, hit the like button. Leave a comment. That's more so that the YouTube algorithm will share Abraham's wisdom with more people. You can subscribe, you can become a supporter, all that's fine. For me, it's a joy just to be able to talk to people, and I'm going to do more of that. I've been in a real hibernation, and you're one of the first people I'm talking to now that's bringing me out of it, and I feel really honored.
I'm so glad.
Thank you, brother.
Honor. Thank you.
Hey, it's Dr. Z. Thanks for getting through the whole episode. That's a huge accomplishment. And so at this point, I just got to ask you for a few favors, because it just helps us so much if you leave a review on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe. It just really helps the algorithm to get this message out to others. The second thing is email me, hello@zdogmd.com. I get all these emails personally. I can't respond to them all, but I need to hear your voice, because especially on podcast, we don't have a comment section. And I want to hear how this episode affected you, what you'd like to hear in the future, what you think we got wrong, what we think we got right, anything, or just say hi. So that's really powerful. And the third thing is, financially, it helps us a lot to support the show in any way you can. And if you go to zdogmd.com/supporters, you can join our supporter tribe on your favorite platform, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, wherever. What that will get you on those platforms is live shows with me that are exclusive for supporters, and access to our Zoom meetings, where we talk about awakening realization and we share with each other our own experience. It's a powerful group effect. It's a community, really. And we support and love each other and share, again, through our own experience, how we're waking up. So, and that ripples out into systems, into transforming healthcare and education and government. So it really starts with us. So join us there if you can. Again, zdogmd.com/supporters. And I'm so grateful to have you with us.